Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Our guest today is Marine retired Lieutenant Colonel Hal Kempfer, and we're going to talk about what's going on in Ukraine. I mean, right up to 2 seconds ago, we are still looking at headlines. Thanks for joining us, Hal. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Sherry. Thanks for having me on.
We've been texting back and forth with things that are popping up in the news, and is there any truth to the coup that they're talking about?
Well, it's almost an aspirational thing. The major general that runs Ukrainian intelligence put out this statement, and he says there's a coup underway to remove Putin. But then as you go into it, he says it'll probably happen sometime around midsummer or August. So it doesn't sound like anybody's kicking in the doors or hauling them out into the yard or anything. It was more within the context of, say, the war will be ended by the, he thinks the war will be done, Russia will be defeated by the end of the year. So it was more of a projection thing, although the fact that he used the term coup certainly got global press attention. The reality is, Putin politically, there's all the indicators that he's in a lot of trouble. And certainly last Monday, when he did the Victory Day speech, and he, you know, admitted that there were huge casualties on the Russian side, and also he backed off of saying a lot of things that we're wondering if he was going to say, for example, declaring war in Ukraine, which would have led to a national mobilization. Or trying to declare victory in Ukraine, which I think even at that point, despite the huge Russian propaganda machine, they said, look, there's only so much we can do. We can't really make that one sound true. He backed off of those things and didn't say it. So there is a lot of indicators that, yeah, his power is eroding. And a lot of the people around him, very senior level in the security service, the FSB, in the Ministry of Defense, you know, he's removed them. In fact, there's a report out this week that General Gerasimov, the chief of the armed forces, may be under house arrest right now, which is that's the equivalent to General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So that gives you a sense of just how politically tectonic things are moving within Moscow.
I know that Sweden and Finland have decided to apply for NATO, and now Turkey is saying, I object.
Oh,
it's just like, come on.
you know, it's interesting. Yeah, Erdogan, just a little bit of a fly in the ointment for NATO across the board. Sometimes he does stuff that was like, that's great, and other times we just scratch our heads. And, of course, Turkey's always had that, you know, Turkey is a unique NATO member. Is it in Europe or is it in Asia?
Right.
And the answer is yes, you know, geographically speaking. Or is it really more part of the Middle East? And, again, the answer is yes, geographically speaking. But, you know, he is, despite the fact that they hold something that looks like elections, he is basically positioned himself as effectively a dictator in Turkey. And with that, he also is doing things to bolster his position, which he, as near as we can tell, never plans to give up. And so a lot of what you're hearing with the Sweden-Finland thing is really for a domestic audience in Turkey. You know, he kept bringing up the Kurds. He kept bringing up more violent Kurdish movements, you know, that they certainly assess as terrorist groups like the PKK, and saying that, you know, that Finland and Sweden cannot be allowing these Kurds to do this stuff. He also pointed to a cleric in the U.S., which has also been a big issue for him. He thinks that he was in charge, that he was connected to the coup or the attempted coup that took place in Turkey. And that's a whole other discussion as to whether that was a coup or whether it was a manufactured coup. Experts are still kind of trying to figure that one out. But basically, he's playing to a domestic audience. So when he's doing that, he's just saying, hey, you know, I may be in a position here where I could get some concessions that would look good, and I can come out looking strong and forceful and influential on the world scene, which will play well with my domestic base in Turkey. And I think that's what you're seeing, and I'm sure they're all working. Interestingly, he was talking about the Kurds in relation to Finland and Sweden, and the country in Scandinavia that actually does have a little bit more of an open entree with some of the more extreme Kurdish movements is actually Denmark, which is actually part of NATO already. So what you and of course the U.S. is where the cleric is, that he wants extradited to Turkey sits. So, you know, he's saying this about Finland and Sweden, but it's basically just an opportunity for him to do that. I'm hoping they can diplomatically kind of work through this with either something where they give him something or that he just moves past it.
Well, I was wondering, too, because they were saying that Sweden will probably be entered into NATO on Monday. How come they're not helping Ukraine, who's been begging?
They are. Sweden actually has been sending a lot of weapons to Ukraine. I used to live in Denmark a long, long time ago, and during the Cold War, and I just have to tell you that the shift. You know, Sweden has only been neutral for about 200 years. That's all.
Yeah.
So for them to join NATO, to join a military alliance, this is such a huge change. Finland, they've been neutral ostensibly since, you know, of course they were invaded by the Soviet Union back in 1939 and fought them to a standstill as well. They also, they've already said, hey, we're going this direction. Sweden has been saying we're going to go this direction if Finland goes this direction. So Monday, you're probably going to see the same thing from Sweden that you just saw from Finland. They plan to extradite it. Most everything I'm hearing sounds like this thing could be in place by June, sometime in June. And NATO has actually said that they've cleared out office space and they have desks assigned and everything for Finnish and Swedish officers. Wow. So that tells you how fast they're moving on this entire thing.
That's impressive, but they should do that for Ukraine too.
Well, I will say this. All right. Macron this week kind of threw a little bit of a monkey wrench into Ukraine becoming a European Union member. Basically saying, look, they have to meet all the requirements. We got to agree to stuff. And it's true. The European Union is a very complex bureaucracy, to say the least. That's one of the reasons that Britain pulled out, was they said, we're tired of dealing with this, because they felt it was a bureaucracy that was not really oriented towards British interests. So there are a lot of things dealing with trade, dealing with agriculture, manufacturing, services, you name it. It's a very complex bureaucracy. So he said, look, they're going to have to do this. It may take a long time, alluding to it may take up to a decade before Ukraine comes into the EU. And everyone has assumed that Ukraine going into the European Union would precede Ukraine going into NATO. As this war with Russia has drug on longer and longer, and Zelensky actually made overture saying, look, we'll stay out of NATO, you know, if you just sit down and talk. And as Russia has pretty much rebuffed all attempts for serious, you know, concrete negotiations, and instead has just kept throwing resources trying to destroy Ukraine and take Ukrainian territory, I think that whole NATO joining NATO, you know, the Ukraine not joining NATO, I should say, ship, it may have sailed already.
Okay.
And I think that that when this thing is resolved, there will be a move to get Ukraine into NATO sooner rather than later. And at that point, we're probably looking at a militarily debilitated Russia as well, because they're taking enormous losses there. And I don't see them able to rebuild their conventional military forces very quickly after this whole thing is done.
I noticed that the Ukraine has started war crime trials.
Yes, they have. They have a. There's a. Interesting, as a Russian sergeant, and he admits that he. I think he murdered a civilian under orders. Jeez. It's an interesting trial. He has assigned legal counsel from Ukraine. It's not clear if he might. It wasn't clear to me. I haven't seen this morning, but as of yesterday, it wasn't clear if he was going to plead guilty to doing this. And it really brings up a lot of issues in terms of this is Ukraine doing this internally. It's not the International Court of the Hague.
That's what
it's
I was wondering.
International Tribunal. It just is interesting to see this. I think the evidence is fairly overwhelming, to say the very least. The fact that they're going through this, it's not completely unprecedented, but it's a little unusual to do stuff like this. He's going to definitely be, you know, held prisoner till probably the end of the war. And but you know, this trial may be followed by another trial that they do on the international scene. You know, they're working out all the issues right now on how they're going to deal with the war crimes. And certainly Ukraine's interests would be if the war crimes trials are done in a multilateral, you know, globally or internationally recognized situation. And, well, that's, and when one country does that, I hate to say it, but that sounds a lot like things that we've seen that have really irritated us in the past, where, you know, other countries, whether it's Russia, China, North Korea, they hold these trials that we don't really think are fair trials. I think the Ukrainian jurisprudence system is probably, you know, far superior to anything that those other countries would do. And I think they're trying to do something in a fair manner. There's a heck of an impetus for the Ukrainian government to address these war crimes and these atrocities. So that's part of the timing on this as well, is to get this thing underway. But I think the end state goal would be to do something with the international court. And but it's going to be a huge backlog. I mean, right now, they're talking, you know, depending on which one you look at, I've heard 60 suspects. I've heard up to 700 suspects.
Oh, my God.
That they're looking at for thousands of war crimes. And I think it's going to get actually bigger than that. I would not be surprised if by the time it's done, we're looking at thousands of Russian soldiers and probably the entire chain of command up to Putin that'll be indebted for war crimes.
How long does a process like that take? Are we talking
Sherry?
Decades? Hello?
Oh, hold on, Sherry. I got a little audio issue here.
Okay.
Sherry, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. Sorry. I had a little audio issue there. Sorry.
The process like that, does it take decades? How long does something like that take if you're talking, you know, 700 people-ish to go through?
It may take a long time. It'll take years. You know, it took a long time with the after World War II. It took quite a bit of time with the trials in Japan and Germany. Japan actually took longer than Germany. The Nuremberg trials is the one we all point to. But the trials in Japan actually took longer. So it will take a while. And we may be talking, you know, several years. You know, after World War II, going after the Nazis, you know, they were doing that for decades after World War II because they had to track down all the Nazis. And I think that we're going to have the same issue with Russian soldiers and other Russian officials, that we may have indictments that sit out there for decades. And, you know, we'll have something like an Interpol red notice out there on these guys. And the moment they step into a country where we can take them into custody and extradite them, we will. But it may take a very long time.
Okay, you say extradite them to where?
Probably to the Hague.
Okay.
Probably to the International Court. Again, and nothing's set in stone if that's where they decide to do it. I don't know.
But they can't just ignore it, because some of the things that I've been hearing is it's just horrific.
Oh, it's horrendous. And I would be stunned if there was ever an attempt to ignore what's been happening, but it just, it can't be, you know, we also, that video that CNN posted or put out this week, which was security video, CCTV video from a facility, near Kyiv. And it was from early in the invasion, but where you saw the owner and a security guard at a facility, they actually went out to greet the Russian soldiers as they came in. They talked to them. They were searched by the Russian soldiers. They smoked cigarettes with them. And then as the two Ukrainian citizens walked away back into the facility, the Russians came around the corner and shot them in the back, full-blooded murder. And that was all over, posted out there. That's just one that's been caught in video in that fashion. You know, we have uncovered, or I should say the Ukrainians have uncovered, you know, hundreds of very clear cases of torture, you know, execution, many times with Ukrainians having their hands tied behind their backs and basically shot in the back or shot in the back of the head. Very clear executions that took place. Evidence of torture, and of course, all the, you know, all the reports of rape and everything else, which I have to say, it looks a lot like the Soviet Army of World War II in terms of the conduct of the soldiers involved.
Do you think those were orders, or are these just, you know, people going off on their own tangents and doing what they think they want to do and what they can get away with?
That's what's interesting, is this case in that they're currently trying in Kyiv. In that case, the sergeant, the Russian sergeant, said he was actually following orders. He was actually under orders to do that. And there is a principle, within the military of responsibility, command responsibility. So, you know, if the commanders are allowing this to happen, you know, if they're setting a command climate where this is okay, if they're not taking all the necessary measures to prevent stuff like this from happening, the chain of command can be held responsible regardless. So even if soldiers weren't ordered specifically to kill that civilian, if they can go back and say, yeah, but, you know, they allowed this sort of stuff to happen, the officers in charge can be held accountable. So,
well, yeah, they should be.
And that goes all the way up to Putin, by the way. So, yeah.
So I've been out of town for a few days this week, so I'm a little behind on what's going on. I heard that there was another ship, Russian ship, that was set on fire.
Oh, yeah. You know, for a Navy that has no ships afloat right now, the Ukrainians are really very capable. They're hitting these Russian ships with anti-ship missiles and with drone missiles fired from drones. Last night, it's either 8 or 9 Russian ships that have been seriously damaged or sunk. Of course, the most famous one was the Moskva, the flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. Big heavy cruiser, and, you know, probably if not the most modern ship that the Russians had. That, of course, that ship sunk. The latest one was a logistics ship, and I haven't seen anything that says it sunk, but everything, to include video, indicates it was very, very seriously damaged. Massive fire on board, and I would say that ship's taken out of commission. And when these ships are damaged, because of all the supply chain issues that they have and all logistics issues, it's not something where these ships, even if they bring them back to port, that they can put them back in service anytime soon. If they're seriously damaged, they're probably just going to sit there for at least the duration of the war, and probably just a ship that's waiting to be scrapped at some point in the future. So, you know, what's interesting is, remember Snake Island?
Yeah.
The island where the... Yeah, that was the Moskva that actually issued that order for the for the Ukrainians on Snake Island to surrender. It's a really small island. I think it's like 46 acres. It's a big chunk of rock that sits out there in the Black Sea, not far from Odessa. But if you control Snake Island, you basically, it's strategic in terms of being able to control access to the port of Odessa. So that's the importance of Snake Island. The Russians took it, and there really was no way for the Ukrainians to actually defend that rock, that island. But they have made the Russians consistently pay over and over again for holding that island. They've taken out at least one or two anti-air defense systems on the island. They hit a helicopter when it was landing on the island. That was a rather spectacular thing. That was in video. I think that was a drone strike.
Awesome.
They've hit multiple ships that have been tied up around the island, have been taken out. It looked like they hit a command post on the island with one strike. So it's like the Russians own it, but it's kind of like almost this big target sitting out in the Black Sea. And the Ukrainians go out there and hit it over and over again. So they're making the Russians pay for holding that island a lot. And this logistics ship was just the latest in a series of things tied to that island in terms of what the Russians have had to incur as far as holding that island and trying to use that island.
Do you think the Ukrainians will take it back?
Well, I think at some point they will. Yeah, I'm very confident. The Ukrainians, going to the south is going to be probably the last part of the war. The big thing was yesterday, a number of people looking at this, but particularly the Institute for the Study of War, which is probably one of the best open source intelligence resources out there in looking at the Ukraine conflict, has said basically the Battle of Kharkiv has been won in the same way that they declared the Battle of Kyiv had been won at some point. And the Russians were under tremendous pressure by the Ukrainians, have been withdrawing forces. And I've been watching this since literally before last weekend. It looked like a lot of the Russian units weren't so much being pushed back as they were actually withdrawing those units. And it's the same sort of thing we saw around Kyiv, where the Russian units were unable to conduct offensive warfare. In other words, they couldn't go on the offense, and they would then go into the defense, but then they were unable to defend their positions, which left them the situation where either they get overrun or they start to withdraw. And north of Kyiv, the withdrawal turned into basically a strategic withdrawal where they pulled all their forces out of that entire area north of Kyiv. And it looks like they're doing the same thing around Kharkiv as well, which then starts to push south. It's in the eastern part of the country, but then starts to push south or southeast, where you start seeing eventually they would probably start pushing into the Donbas region itself, which is that the two oblasts or provinces that Russia has declared as independent states that they intend to eventually incorporate into the Russian Federation. And the Ukrainians are moving that direction very quickly. In fact, I was just seeing this morning something I've been watching for a few days, which is the Ukrainian forces are moving so quickly, there's a chance, there's a little, it's almost like a finger to the south, a city called Izium. And for a long time, it was seen that the Russians might try to push down this Izium axis to try and encircle Ukrainian forces that were kind of in a almost like a bulge in the Russian lines. And so they want to encircle them and cut them off. And that's kind of going the other way because the Ukrainians are cutting them off up north. There's a chance that the Ukrainians might cut off the Russian forces in that Izium axis. And there's estimates that up to 20,000 or more Russian troops might actually end up getting cut off from their supply lines. That's a stunning reversal for the Russians. And then the question is, what are those troops going to do? Will those units try to fight their way out?
Or give up?
They even have them, or give up. And yeah. It's like World War II stuff when you look at it.
Exactly. Yeah. And it sounds with the morale of the Russian military doesn't sound like it's what Putin expected.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's just too bad. Okay. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Stay with us. Thank you for staying with us. Our guest today is Marine retired Lieutenant Colonel Hal Kempfer. We're talking about Ukraine and the craziness that's going on over there. And John and I were just talking. John is he operates the board and turns off our mics if we don't say nice things about him. he was just wondering, why is Putin continuing to do, and it's obviously a losing battle, why does he continue with this? Why doesn't it just stop?
He's stuck. If he admits defeat and pulls out, he's politically done for. And he doesn't have the means to achieve victory. So he's basically trapped himself, you know, and so he's just going to keep doing this as long as he can. What's interesting is it's almost getting beyond anecdotal to sounding almost institutional within the Russian army. Is troops, soldiers, even junior leaders, refusing to take their units into combat or refusing to take their units or their personnel into Ukraine.
A losing battle.
And they all recognize that this is it's a losing battle. It's a meat grinder in there. You know, the Ukrainians are fierce. Their will to fight is extremely strong, and the Russians, you know, their tactics, everything. I mean, one of the things that the Russians, they have this very, very hierarchical system that stifles initiative at the tactical level. And so they will order troops. This is what they did in World War II, but they had an enormous amount of resources, particularly personnel, that they could throw in these battles. So they would have these rather lackluster tactics, but they would simply overwhelm the German forces with mass. And that's the way they kind of fought their way to Germany, was by overwhelming the German forces with sheer mass. Well, they don't have the troops in order to pull that off, and they've never adapted their doctrine to fit their reality. So you'll see these very uncoordinated things where the air operations and even down to the more tactical ground level, the artillery and the tactical rockets, they're hitting things, but it's not in any coordinated fashion. And so, you know, the artillery will come in and cause a tremendous amount of devastation, but that doesn't necessarily tie into a significant maneuver on the ground. It's supposed to, but it doesn't. And then the air operations are almost on their own. They go do their own thing. Their concept of close air support is very, very different from what we think of. And so, you know, one of the things they needed to do was to garner what we call air superiority early into the conflict. They've never been able to do that. Even though they have a theory, you know, on paper, they have this overwhelming superiority in air assets and should have been able to accomplish that, they can't. And I think it was just a couple of days ago, they went over 200 for the first time. 200 fixed-wing aircraft have been shot down by the Ukrainians. Believe me, every pilot in the Russian Air Force recognizes that and realizes the threat that they're under when they fly over Ukrainian airspace. And it's not getting any better for them, because when the UK started moving in those Starstreak manned portable air defense systems, they're extremely capable. Those missiles fly Mach 3.5. They're just, you know, in many cases, by the time you realize that a Starstreak missile has been fired at an aircraft, the aircraft is already breaking up in the sky. That's how fast they are.
Wow.
And the Russian pilots know this. They, you know, if they come in close where they can actually hit targets, there's a very good chance that one of those missiles might be fired up at them And by the time they realize that that it's coming at them, it's too late. They can't do anything. So it gets into the psychology of the pilot. So they tend to be very reticent to put themselves in danger. And the more reluctant they are, the less accurate they are, the less effect the weapons have, militarily speaking.
Yeah, you'd have to think if you were a Russian pilot, that's a kamikaze mission. you may as well give it up.
What they'll do is they'll fly high, and they'll try to avoid getting into areas where they get shot down, which usually means that whatever they do has little effect. Yeah, unfortunately, what they tend to do is they'll release their bombs, but a lot of times they'll release them over civilian areas, and hence you have essentially more war crimes because of the indiscriminate use of firepower.
Well, I read that North Korea has been shooting off missiles. Do you think they're just flexing their muscles because of what Russia is doing, or are they planning on doing anything?
Well, it's interesting. I remember the first couple of weeks of war, and I was on the air, and we were talking about this, and I remember it was one of the things that North Korea is going to do something, and it deals with Kim Jong-un. You know, he can't keep going without the world press paying more attention to him. You know, he has to do these provocative things in order to, at least in his mind, keep himself relevant. So some of the stuff with the missiles, it's a demonstration of capabilities. You know, it's to intimidate, South Korea, Japan, the U.S., and others in the area. So he does this a lot. You know, the threats to, start building, to do nuclear testing underground, all this stuff. It's kind of almost his way of self-actualizing. It's to maintain his relevance. So, with all the global press attention going to Ukraine, it was almost like he had to act out. And in fact, I was on the air last night. We're talking about what's happening now in Israel.
Yes.
And I don't know that a lot of these things are specifically coordinated, but it's almost as if, with so many things happening in quick succession, it's almost as if there's been a strategic decision down there. And I'm sure if Shin Bet or Mossad was here, they'd probably say, yeah, there's been a strategic decision. But by the Palestinians to do things to get themselves back into the news, to make themselves relevant again. And of course, also to capitalize on the fact that, President Biden has a trip coming over there. He's already, said that he might go to East Jerusalem, which is something of an entree to the Palestinians, who have not gotten a lot of attention from the U.S. over recent years. In fact, they had the funding cut off by the U.S. For quite a period of time. So you see this. You'll see things happening in other parts of the world, but specifically the Middle East and in the Korean Peninsula, which is really just almost to remind people that they're still there and there still is an issue there.
I was wondering, why would the White House announce a trip like that?
I mean, yeah, to Israel?
Yeah,
to Israel or to East Jerusalem?
To anywhere.
It's pure political. What's interesting is, Mitch McConnell led a congressional delegation to Kyiv.
Right.
And they met with President Zelensky. That just happened literally last night. That just happened. And Joe Biden had last weekend had gone into Ukraine, not to Kyiv, but into Ukraine as on Mother's Day and met with the First Lady of President Zelensky's wife in Ukraine. And there's been a number of world leaders that have gone to Ukraine. In that situation, you don't want, it's been talked about the president going over there. The POTUS, the president of the United States, all the stuff that goes with him, you don't want to put him in an extremist situation. That whole chain of command, that commander-in-chief thing over our strategic forces and everything else, I can tell you across the board, you're like, no, that is not a good idea. And no, you don't sneak the president onto a train and zip him across a war zone into Kyiv. That's just not going to happen. And so some of these things, but Israel, you know, U.S. presidents have gone to Israel. That's not really a huge challenge. And for arranging for the president to go into East Jerusalem, that really isn't an overwhelming thing. Now, if he decided to go into the Gaza Strip, that would be a completely different thing. I can tell you, I would feel a high degree of assurance that the Secret Service would be having some very strong objection to some idea like that. But East Jerusalem, that's a tourist area. You know, the Israelis are in East Jerusalem all the time, and that's not something. I mean, they're there. So, from a security perspective, the president going into East Jerusalem, not that tough. Certainly going to Israel, not a difficult thing to do. But there are some places like Ukraine, Kyiv, where you're just not going to see the president going over there anytime soon. It's too dangerous. And by the way, you know, one of the problems with the president going to someplace, say, like Kyiv, okay, how does he get in there? Well, the thought would be take Air Force One. Well, Air Force One is exposed the whole time it's going in there. So right. Normally what they'll do is they'll put a combat air patrol around Air Force One. Once you put a combat air patrol around Air Force One, you've now got U.S. fighters flying in Ukrainian airspace that's being contested by Russia. And we have created the very situation we've been trying to avoid, which is our forces coming into direct conflict with Russian forces.
Yeah.
And that could happen. So, you know, yeah, some places you're absolutely right. You just don't want the president announcing that he's going there or even going there.
Yeah, it's better to know after the fact.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, I've read that the United Kingdom has been sanctioning some of Putin's relatives, his mistress, his ex-wife, his cousin Igor. I was just like, really? You've got a cousin named Igor? Okay. So how effective is this going to be? I mean, this is just happening now. How effective is this going to be, and how does Putin feel about it?
I don't know, but, you know, it is interesting the number of people. You mentioned Igor, but I was thinking, yeah, I think they're going after Boris and Natasha, and they have a talk of moose and a flying squirrel working on that right now. Well, what it is, this really, it comes out of 2014. What was observed was sanctions were put on a number of key Russian oligarchs and officials. And so what they did was they just transferred their wealth to their family members and others who are close to them. And so they actually maintained their wealth status, if you will, their financial and business control over their enterprises, but they did it in a more distributed means. So as far as the sanctions thing, and this is a big change for Britain. You know, Britain was I don't know if you want to say famous or notorious for being the go-to city for Russian oligarchs. You know, they basically were that was the place where Russian oligarchs would park their money. They'd park themselves, and frankly, with all the money coming in from Russia, you know, the United Kingdom was rather, you know, accommodating towards this money coming because it was good for the British economy. It's particularly good for the London economy. But there's another side there. I mean, that's a double-edged sword because you also have all these oligarchs there and others. So Great Britain is cracking down on this in a great deal. And, you know, interestingly, going after his ex-wife and going after his mistress, his primary mistress, and that gets into a whole other discussion, but his most famous mistress, I should say. I'm not saying that the mistress sanction regime is done. They may add more names to that by the time it's all finished. But they're going after him because that's the way he hides his wealth. He hides his money. You know, Putin is estimated to, you know, he has this thing where he says, "I am just a humble civil servant, and I make $140,000 a year, and I am serving the Russian people." Okay, that's what he puts out there. That's his propaganda machine. It's estimated by most experts Putin's personal wealth may be about $200 billion.
Wow.
That's how much money he's ripped off. So, you know, when those Russian troops are going into Ukraine and their tires blow out because they never replaced the tires and their engine seizes because they didn't do maintenance and half of the artillery rounds don't fire because they're duds, well, the money that was supposed to go pay for stuff like that went somewhere else. And it wasn't all Putin. It went into a lot of these oligarchs' pockets. It is interesting that Putin, who is, you know, of all the corrupt Russian officials, was the premier corrupt Russian official in charge of this kleptocracy that is the Russian government. It is ironic that his biggest initiative, for lack of a better term, is basically falling apart, and it's falling apart in large part because of the kleptocratic practices of his regime, to include him personally. You know, they basically stole from the Russian military, but also stole from the Russian people, stole blind, and now they've got themselves into a big war, and they can't win it because of all the corrupt things that they did before to fleece all those funds. So I think that may be something that we look at for a lot of years hence. It will be one of those stunning things when we look at, you know, corruption, you know, government corruption. And I do that. I go around the world and, you know, I work with various different countries on things. And one of the things that's always, you know, when we're doing this, we always have to be careful how we phrase it. But I will say that you can go to countries where there's a lot of government corruption. And when you close the door and you talk to the officials there, they'll be the first to say, yeah, we got a lot of government corruption here, you know, and they'll be the first to admit it. And they're not quite sure how to address it. But one of the things that we need to recall is historically, when regimes are extremely corrupt, they lose legitimacy in the eyes of the people, and they just don't last. And, you know, Afghanistan, what was one of the biggest problems with the U.S.-backed regime? It was seen by the Afghan people as extremely corrupt. South Vietnam, it was seen by the Vietnamese people as extremely corrupt. And you can go throughout, you know, Cuba, before Castro took over, same thing. So, you know, it's going to be one of those things where I think this will be one of the more remarkable moments in looking at governmental corruption and how it impacted a country in such a strategic way.
What do you think, once Putin is gone, what kind of a government will Russia have? Is it going to be the same, or do you think somebody with a brain is going to come in and take over?
Gosh, I wish I knew.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. That's a question everyone's asking themselves. What will it be? What I will say is this. I don't know. And I don't think, look, I don't think you're going to see the forces of democracy and freedom sweep over the Kremlin. All right. I don't think it's going to be Bastille Day, all right, in Moscow. But what I do see is this. There is a basic political economic reality, which is whatever the next regime, presuming, and I'm going to go with the presumption, I don't think the Ukrainians are far off saying that Putin's days are numbered, all right? And I would imagine it would be somebody high enough up in the current government that they would control some levers of power. So it's not going to be something completely, you know, completely divorced from what we see currently. However, to get the international sanctions dropped against Russia, to get Russia back into the global economy, back into the community of nations, they're going to have to make enormous changes in governance in order to be acceptable on the international stage. And one of the big problems, and it's taking a while, one of the big problems they're going to run into is that the major exports that they rely on for revenue, oil and gas, Europe is weaning itself away from Russia.
Yeah.
And they're going to want to, you know, I can tell you Russians at some point would want to turn that back on. They're not going to be able to do that as long as there's a Putin-esque type regime, even if it's not Putin, but a Putin-esque type regime still controlling Russia. And so I don't know where that will go. I don't know.
But it's gonna be interesting.
Yeah, I think they're going to try and create a – I think there will be a real incentive to create a regime that looks legitimate in the eyes of the world. And that's why I keep thinking we're going to pop back into the time machine and go back to 1992, politically speaking. There's a very good chance it may look like what happened in 1992 after the fall of the Soviet Union. It'll be a little confused. It'll be it'll be a lot of moving parts, if you will. But you know, if we can coalesce, if the Western alliance and NATO and the European Union and everybody can coalesce and really put the attention onto helping Russia develop into a, you know, something other than what it is now, there might be an opportunity to do what we didn't do back in the early 90s, which a lot of historians and others feel that we missed an enormous opportunity there.
Yeah.
to really change Russia. And maybe, but now we're projecting way forward because right as of today, Putin's still in power. Russian forces are still fighting in Ukraine. So, you know.
Okay, Putin's health. Everybody said, oh, he's going to go in for surgery. And I'm like, okay, slip that doctor a C note and see what happens. But what's going on with Putin's health? Is there any legitimacy to people say he's got cancer, he's got blood cancer, he's got Parkinson's disease, or, you know, there's just all these stories coming out. What's going on?
Well, I think, Sherry, you saw the seminar that I did online where we talked about Putin's health, and I showed some of the stuff where, you know, he met with Lukashenko before the invasion. And he's in his office, and the way he's moving, it clearly looks like he has symptoms or signs of potential Parkinson's. There was a meeting he had with Shoigu, his defense minister, and the way he's gripping the table, his involuntary tapping of his foot, his body posture, everything looks like he's suffering from something, Parkinson's. He just, and he looks, and many have said many times, he looks puffy. Yeah. As if they're giving him steroids to counteract treatment for cancer,
right.
All right? And there's been a number of cancer things. The latest one they say is he has blood cancer. I've heard he had thyroid cancer. I've heard that's a third different type of cancer that he's supposed to have. I heard he had leukemia a couple months back. That was a widely rumored thing in Kyiv that Ukrainian officials thought he was being treated for leukemia. With that said, I don't know if you saw the stuff Monday during the Victory Day parade. He comes out there. He walks out there. He literally bounces up the steps, greets all the old World War II veterans and all these other veterans up on the podium, all these dignitaries, officials, just like an energetic Western-style politician. He gets up and gives a speech, and then there's a part where he does this long walk with various people holding the pictures of World War II veterans in their hands and sometimes holding flowers. It's a very long walk. He's walking. He looks able-bodied. He's joking. He's smiling with everybody. And it's like all those symptoms that we've seen in previous videos had disappeared. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just don't know. I don't know.
It's so confusing. I mean, you hear so many different things. You don't know what's real. But he's still there. And he's still doing what he's doing, and I think most of it's ego. He can't realize that he's not going to win this war.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
I think he's you know, 27,000 killed in action for Russia is the Ukrainian estimate right now.
Wow.
And you can multiply that by two or three. So in terms of wounded, surrendered, deserted on top of that. So you're probably looking at potentially over 100,000 Russians that have been taken out of combat one way or other since this thing began. It's an enormous number. You know, 1,200 tanks have been destroyed, almost 3,000 armored personnel carriers. It's just stunning when you look at the losses that Russia has taken on this. And yet they still keep going. And I mean, that's what Russia's always been famous for, is this brutal disregard for their own forces and their own personnel. And we're seeing that, you know, exemplified in a major way with this conflict. So,
and how do you justify that to the Russian people?
They lie. But, you know, Monday he had to admit that they had suffered huge losses. He did say that in his speech. He didn't say a lot of things, but he did admit huge losses. And he wouldn't have said that unless he knew that, you know, even that big Russian propaganda machine has limits.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, there is that Mothers of Russia thing, which is you can only hide this stuff so much. And the Mothers of Russia will speak. And when their sons don't come home from the war, they have a strong voice. And this was one of the major movements that led to the fall of the Soviet Union. And that was in the aftermath of the Afghan War, where actually less than half, or about half of, maybe not less than half, but about half of the, let's say this, the Ukrainian losses right now are assessed as almost twice what the total losses in the Afghanistan war were for Russia. And that war lasted over a decade. This thing's only been going for about 3 months. So, you know, today, you know, along with the reports of the coup and everything else, you know, the head of Ukrainian intelligence said this war was going to go out throughout the summer. So if they've lost this now, and we're coming into the summer months where it'll probably be very pitched war fighting, who knows? By the time we get to September, everything we're looking at now could have doubled in terms of Russian losses. And I don't know how they hide that, because if those losses double, then you're talking the number of Russians killed in the Ukraine over what, a 6 or 7 month period, would be the number would equal or be greater than the number of Americans lost in the entire Vietnam War. And certainly that had huge political implications in the U.S. So,
well, we are actually out of time. I want to thank you again for bringing us up to date and clearing up some of the propaganda that's going out there, and wish you a happy weekend.
All right, you too, Sherry, and thanks for having me on. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, until next week, shop local and stay safe.